You're almost through the week. It's Friday. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. This week in San Francisco, Google held its annual Developers Conference. The internet search giant debuted updates for just about everything from Google Plus to Gmail to Maps and gave talks on gadgets like Google Glass. And as NPR Steve Henn reports, Google laid out its vision for its future, as well as our future.
Google's annual Developers Conference is probably the best chance to get a sense of where this giant company is headed. When Amit Singhal, who runs Google Search, walked out on stage, there was a big blank screen above his head with four tiny words: the end of search.
Yes.
The audience in the vast Moscone Center Hall fell completely silent.
It's a provocative title, indeed, especially coming from Google. But I believe with good reason.
Today, Amit Singhal says Google is rolling out new ways to search, including one where you can just talk to your computer.
Amit was talking about hot wording.
Johanna Wright is vice president of product management at Google.
So no hands. Okay, Google, show me things to do in Santa Cruz.
Here are popular attractions in Santa Cruz.
But simply talking to a computer to search is just the beginning.
Okay, Google, how far is it from here?
The drive from your location to Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk is 73.9 miles.
Think about what Wright actually said. How far is it from here? Google could answer that question because Google knew where Wright was standing, and it put her question in the context of her previous search. Google knew it, in this case, was Santa Cruz. And if she goes to Santa Cruz and is standing on the boardwalk and asks,
how tall do you have to be to ride the Giant Dipper?
Google will know Wright is talking about a roller coaster. Again and again this week, Google showed off products that were possible because this company is now collecting information about us in all sorts of ways. No longer is a search query simply made up of a string of words. Now, in many ways, your location, your past behavior, your history, your interactions with other people are all part of one constant ongoing search, a search to reach you with new useful information or ads at key moments. Take Google Maps.
Wouldn't it be awesome if you could build billions of maps, one for every user?
Bernie Seefeld at Google says Google's new maps will adapt to you individually. His Google map of San Francisco will highlight his favorite restaurant, Francis. Mine would look different. And his map will offer personalized recommendations.
Like Bar Tartine shows up because it's similar to Francis, and I like Francis, so it's a recommendation for me.
Whether you find this kind of thing creepy or cool, there's an enormous amount of technical wizardry behind all of this. Brian McLind at Google says the company's constantly piecing together bits of information to gain new insights.
This idea of generating data from other data is fundamental to what Google does.
And Google is using similar computer science techniques to create even more detailed, nuanced pictures of us, its users. For example, Google Plus now offers a service where Google will organize your vacation photos for free, automatically picking out the best shots. Vic Gundatra, who runs Google Plus, says the service recognizes important landmarks, whether or not people are smiling, and even
who's important to you? Who's in your family circle? And we apply appropriate social boosts so that your wife and your children are in the highlights.
To do that, Google has to run facial recognition on your photos, try to identify who you're traveling with, who your friends are, who you're closest to. And in the process, those photos become another piece of data for Google to mine. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
As regular listeners to this program know, Google data mining activities raise privacy concerns for many people, and so does one of the company's most talked about new products. Google Glass is getting attention from Capitol Hill. Eight members of Congress are asking the company how it plans to protect people's privacy once Google customers are walking around with little cameras mounted beside their eyes on the equivalent of eyeglass frames. In a letter mailed yesterday, the lawmakers asked Google what it would do to prevent Google Glass from unintentionally collecting data about Google Glass users as well as the people who come into the camera's view without their consent. The company declined to comment but has previously said that data gathered by the new device will be handled in accordance with existing privacy policies. Here's a different way to think about retirement. Instead of waiting until the end of your career, why not use some of your savings to take a year off every once in a while during your career? A Massachusetts man did that and took his family to live on an island above the Arctic Circle for what counted as a retirement year. From member station WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch has their story.
By all the laws of anything, Winston Chen should not have quit his well-paying mid-career job at a software company. But one day he was watching one of those online video presentations. A TED Talk by a New York designer.
He presented this absolutely irresistible idea. He said, why don't we take 5 years out of retirement and spread them throughout your working life?
Chen told his wife about it. At first, convention held them at bay.
We feel the gravitational pull of what you should do as well as anybody.
2 summers ago, they broke that gravitational pull. Chen took his family about 3,500 miles away to Urede, a small granite island jutting from the Norwegian Sea north of the Arctic Circle. Chen's wife, Kristen Botnen, was born in Norway, but she says it wasn't about returning home or leaving home.
For us, this was not an escape. We really liked our lives, but we still wanted wanted a year where we could just do something completely different.
Completely different. Winston and Kristen and their 2 kids, 4 and 6 years old, used the daylight that burns into the wee hours of the morning that far north to explore the island of fewer than 200 residents. In their home videos, they discovered beaches so pristine they looked tropical, except the water was really cold. And they went out on the water to fish for the big cod that roamed the Barents Sea.
Holy moly!
They made chips by frying fish skin, they picked berries that bulged under the long Arctic sun, and they plucked eggs from seagull nests to cook for breakfast. It was wild, it was pristine, and it got dark. During the deep Arctic winter, the horizon held the sun down for months.
I say the Northern Lights are the only consolation for the Arctic winter, which is otherwise dark and stormy and cold.
I don't think that the cold got any of us, but the darkness, I think that could make any stable soul a little bit shaky.
To keep things stable, Chen mapped out an hourly schedule in a color-coded spreadsheet, basically a to-do list for his 1 year early retirement.
I had oil painting, photography, blogging, learning Norwegian, learning how to play the ukulele, reading long books that I haven't had time to read.
He also taught himself something new.
While the atmosphere was cordial, the men assembled were hardly friends.
He wrote an iPhone application that reads text out loud.
So part of that was occupying my time when it got dark. So I wrote it without knowing that it would ever see the light of day.
But it did see the light of day. Chen posted it on the Apple App Store under the name VoiceDream, and people started buying it. Now selling more than 500 copies a week at $10 a piece, it's sustaining the family on their return to Boston.
That's the Vosky bear.
Yeah, what is that in English?
Like a washing bear.
It's called a raccoon.
At home in their apartment, Kristen Botnen says the app did not make their Arctic adventure.
It's hard to measure success based on the end product because the process and the year that we had really was a good one.
A good year. A retirement year inserted into their working ones. 1 year that helped them find unexpected riches, personal and professional. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
And you can see a slideshow of the Botnen and Chen family's Arctic adventure at NPR.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. South Beach, Weight Watchers, Atkins, weight loss programs abound. Deborah Sullivan knows this well. She is a dietitian at Kansas University, and she just completed a small pilot study to find out whether the virtual reality computer game, Second Life, could help people lose weight in real life. Her results were promising, and she has secured a grant to continue exploring the question. We talked about how acting out a virtual weight loss regimen could translate into real change.
In real life, you know, in our traditional state-of-the-art weight loss clinics, we have people come in to a group weight loss clinic weekly. We teach them the behaviors they need to do in order to lose weight. And then we ask them to go out into the real world. And the advantage of Second Life is you can go to the grocery store 24 hours a day. You could go to the restaurant and, you know, for example, if you pick the appetizer, spinach artichoke dip, you would click on that food item and get the calorie content, but then also a little tagline, you know, don't let the name fool you. This is not a vegetable. A better choice would be X.
Your study found that Second Life was more effective for some people than programs in person or on the phone, especially with the maintenance part of all of this. Why is that?
Well, we think it's because, you know, for weight loss, it doesn't matter what diet you're doing. If you follow the diet, you're going to be successful and lose weight. It's when you stop that rigid plan, that's when the weight begins to creep back. And so we believe that the behaviors they were able to practice in Second Life translated better compared to our traditional face-to-face group.
What about exercise? Do you take that into account in the Second Life program?
Oh, very much so. Exercise is a core component. We do have a gymnasium. We now have a pool. We have walking paths. We have all sorts of behaviors that you can do in real life. And while I know it might seem silly to think that my avatar is running on a treadmill in my virtual reality, you know, a lot of people that are overweight are not comfortable going into a gym. They've never used a treadmill. Their avatar doing those things in Second Life, we believe, does inspire them to do those activities in real life.
Deborah Sullivan, she is a dietitian at Kansas University Medical Center. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
NPR's business news starts with a big blogging buyout. Today, Yahoo announced its purchase of the blogging site Tumblr. The $1.1 billion deal was unanimously approved by Yahoo's board. Analysts say the acquisition is Yahoo's attempt to revitalize itself. NPR's Kirk Sigler has more.
Tumblr is a New York-based social media and blogging site that's been growing rapidly thanks in part to the exploding use of smartphones and tablets. And then there's Yahoo, which desperately needs relevance, says Kara Swisher, co-editor of All Things D, which first reported the acquisition.
This is a site that's very hip and very cool and has much younger demographic than Yahoo does. And so it's an attempt to try to marry the two together, and hopefully it'll work out. Some people think it will, some people think it won't.
It could be risky at a reported $1.1 billion, but Swisher says Yahoo doesn't have a lot of other options.
They tried to buy Facebook and were unsuccessful, and so I think now they just can't afford to make the mistakes on these up-and-coming sites that might help them continue growth.
The reported deal is the biggest move yet in Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer's short tenure. Mayer, who used to be an executive at Google, has been tasked with reinventing Yahoo, a charge that's already had some early successes, if the company's climbing stock prices are any indication. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
On a Monday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, we'll hear from scientists who want to identify people at risk for depression. They want to do it using the power of computers.
In particular, they're using a virtual therapist. This computer turns its cameras on patients, analyzing how they move and searching for clues about what they're really feeling.
Now, the virtual therapist has a name, Ellie. The NPR reporter who brings you Ellie's story is named Elise Spiegel.
Her hair is brown and tied into a professional-looking ponytail. She wears a blue shirt, tan sweater, and delicate gold chain. From the screen, where she lives out her life, she looks out at the man sitting across from her with curious eyes. He's a real man, sitting in a real chair. And this is the first time that they've talked, so Ellie starts simply, trying to build rapport.
So, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well.
That's good. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Los Angeles.
Oh, I'm from L.A. myself.
Ellie is from L.A. She lives there in a computer at the University of Southern California, the creation of a group of scientists who believe that what they're doing will eventually revolutionize mental health care. They've been working on Ellie for months now, experimenting with giving her different personalities, programming her to ask provocative, open-ended questions, laboring, says project manager Louis Philippe Morrissey, over every element of her interactions.
Everything has been thought of. Just a simple, what we call back channel, like, uh-huh. We have recorded more than 200 of these, uh-huh.
When was the last time you felt really happy?
When was the last time? Probably a couple months ago.
And these are so powerful because a simple uh-huh and a silence, if they're done the right way, can be extremely powerful. So we spend a lot of time on these little details.
But Ellie isn't really intended to replace actual human beings as a therapist. Her real value, the reason that she was created at all, is to help actual therapists diagnose patients, because Ellie can measure people in a way that most humans can't. Underneath the widescreen where Ellie's image sits, there are three devices: a video camera which tracks a person's face, a Microsoft Kinect that tracks their body movement, and a microphone which records their voice. The point of these, says Skip Rizzo, a psychologist who's working on Ellie, is to analyze in almost microscopic detail the way that people talk and move, to read their body language.
We can look at the position of the head, the eye gaze and the head gaze. Does the head tilt? Does it lean forward? Is it static and fixed?
In fact, Ellie tracks and analyzes 60 different body, face, and vocal movements. The theory of this is that a detailed analysis of these movements can give therapists new insight into their patients, because micro changes in the body, face, and voice express things that words sometimes obscure.
You know, people are in a constant state of impression management. They've got their true self and the self that they want to project to the world. And we know that the body displays things that sometimes people try to keep contained.
And so as Ellie gets the person in front of her to ruminate about when they were happy, when they were sad, the machines below her screen measure, cataloging how much the person smiles and for how long, how often they touch their head. Morrissey says they record 30 measurements per second.
Yeah, 30 times 60 seconds, so about 1,800 measurement per minute.
Literally every wince, pause, and verbal stumble is captured.
What advice would you have given yourself 10 or 20 years ago?
To not believe, to not be so gullible, to not be so gullible.
Now, Ellie was commissioned by the military. After all of the deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, the military was seeing a lot of suicides and wanted to find a way to help military therapists catch those suicides before they actually happened. Soldiers don't always like to confess that they're having problems, but maybe their bodies would. This is why Ellie is being programmed to produce a report after each of her sessions, a kind of visual representation of the 60 different movements that she tracks.
For each indicator, we will display three things.
First, the report will show the physical behavior of the person Ellie just interviewed. For instance, how many times they smiled and for how long. Then the report will show how much depressed people typically smile. And finally, how much healthy people typically smile. Essentially, says Morrissey,
it's a visualization of the person's behavior compared to a population of depressed and non-depressed.
If their physical behaviors are similar to someone who's depressed, the person will be flagged. And again, Morrissey insists it's not that Ellie will actually diagnose these people. She's just there, he says, to give insight by providing some objective measurements.
Think about it as a blood sample. You send the blood sample to the lab and you get the result. The person doing the diagnosis is still the clinician, but they use these objective measures to make this diagnosis.
Now, obviously, this work has all kinds of issues. Even on a practical level, there are real obstacles. Jeff Cohn is a psychologist at the University of Pittsburgh who researches the relationship between physical movements and emotion. And he says signals from the face, body, and voice are incredibly complicated to interpret.
Individuals vary a lot in how expressive they are. You know, if I'm someone who's very expressive and I smile frequently, when I'm depressed and smiling less, I may still smile more than you do, you know, if you're a tight-lipped, not very emotive individual.
This means, Cohn says, that using Ellie in the way that blood tests are used, as proof positive of one emotional state or another, will be really difficult.
it strikes me as unlikely that face or voice will provide that information with such certainty.
But Rizzo, the psychologist working on Ellie, genuinely believes these technologies will eventually change mental health. If you can collect enough data from enough humans, he says, you'll be able to see human behavior in a new way. One of the central problems with humans, he says, is that they bring their own biases to whatever they encounter, and those biases often make it hard for them to see what is directly in front of them.
You can get training to be a healthcare provider, a psychologist, and try to put those things on hold and be very objective. But it's still a challenge. It's always going to be biased by our past experience. So what computers offer is the ability to look at massive amounts of data and begin to look for patterns. And that, I think, far outstrips the mere mortal brain.
So are you saying that the computer can see people in a more objective way?
Yes, I would say that, that you're objectively picking up physical events in the world, and the ability to do that on such a grand comprehensive scale with a massive database of past observations, I think you can pull information out of that by using various methodologies in computing that goes beyond a human brain.
This summer, Ellie's being tested. She's scheduled to sit down with about 100 veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. She'll ask them about their lives, encourage them to open up. Then silently, Ellie will measure their answers. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Support for Your Health comes from Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years. NovoNordisk-US.com.
Now to news from another tech giant, Microsoft. The company hasn't had a great couple of years. Its new Windows 8 operating system was held responsible for a recent drop in PC sales, and sales of its Windows phones lag far behind both the iPhone and Google's Android phones. The bright spot for Microsoft has been the Xbox 360. It's the top-selling game console. And tomorrow, Microsoft is expected to announce a new version of the Xbox that's aiming to play a bigger role in consumers' lives. Joining me now to talk about it is NPR's Laura Seidel. And Laura, what do we know about the next generation of the Xbox?
Well, it will be faster. It'll have more storage, better graphics, all that stuff that gamers really love. But I think with this version in particular, it's going to be about a lot more than games. So it's going to be about entertainment. Check this out. So entertainment usage on the Xbox surpassed multiplayer game use last year. So that means that people are spending more time using their Xbox to watch movies and TV on Netflix, that they're actually using it less for games. So I think that Microsoft is likely to find ways to make it even easier to access other forms of entertainment. And I don't know if they will announce all of it tomorrow, but before the Xbox actually hits the stores, I've been told by reliable analysts that the company is working on deals with cable companies that will turn the Xbox into a cable box. Microsoft is basically making a play to reign supreme in your living room.
Well, the big competition for the Xbox is Nintendo and Sony, so are they trying to do what this new Xbox would do as well?
So Nintendo already has the Wii U on the market, and the sales on that device have been kind of disappointing, and they really haven't made a big play for the living room. Sony announced the PS4, not on the market yet. So far, they haven't talked about how it's going to be part of a wider strategy, but before it's released, it's possible they will. Microsoft has some potential advantages. First off, they purchased Skype. So imagine now you'll be able to watch a friend as you're playing a game with them, or chat with them as you're watching a television show. Microsoft also has the Kinect, and the Kinect was an add-on to the Xbox that let you, say, walk in and just use a gesture and begin with the game. And I imagine it's going to be fully integrated into the new Xbox. So, like, you walk in and wave your hand and bring up the entire season of Game of Thrones.
So why is this the strategy, Laura, that Microsoft is taking rather than just sticking to games?
The reality for the game world is that consoles are becoming less and less important. The new frontier is really on mobile devices, so your phone, your tablet computer are game centers. I mean, there's always going to be the hardcore gamers, but really, more and more people who play games are shifting to mobile devices. Most analysts will tell you that that's where the growing audience is, not really on the game console.
So the console has to fill other roles then to stay viable.
Exactly.
Okay, NPR's Laura Seidel. Laura, thanks.
You're welcome.